The Guardian.
I stop and do nothing. Nothing happens. I'm thinking about nothing. I listen to the passing of time. This is time, familiar and intimate. We are taken by it, a rush of seconds, hours, years that hurls us towards life, then drags us toward nothingness.
Time is both deeply mysterious and perfectly obvious. Artists have attempted to capture it, to explore its bewildering meanderings. Scientists have tried to measure it, to explain its intricate workings. But does anyone really understand time? Theoretical physicist Carlo Rovelli has been fascinated by time and its workings for his whole career. In his new book, The Order of Time, he teases apart our intuitions and offers a new way to think about this perplexing phenomenon. But what's wrong with our common sense picture of time? Where does the trouble start? I'm Richard Lee. This is Science Weekly.
Okay, good. So. All right.
When he came to the studio, I started by asking Rovelli how Einstein's theories of relativity challenge our ordinary notions of time.
So modern physics tell us that our intuition is wrong. Of course, it's not wrong in the sense that we shouldn't use it. It's wrong in the sense that it applies well only to our limited domain, right? So in our everyday life, time is what we know it is. But we go wrong if we think that this applies to nature in general. And the biggest challenge to our intuition about time comes from relativity, from Einstein relativity, and in fact from both his theories, special relativity 1905 and general relativity 1915. And both of them strongly questions the validity of our way of thinking about time. The simplest way to understand it, I think, is from general relativity. Some of the ideas are very simple. And one of the key ideas, which was completely shocking when it came out, it turned out to be true, and today we can test it easily with good clocks, is that between one event, I snap my finger, and another event, I snap my finger again, the time lapse between the two is not well-defined because it depends of how I go from one to the other. If I go up a little bit higher in altitude and come down, or if I go lower a little bit, if I move or don't move, I have different durations between these two events.
And you could just measure this with clocks.
And that's a solid fact that today we measure with clocks. And one of the reasons we're talking about this now is that Einstein realized that a century ago. But it's only recently that we can measure it. Taking two clocks and bringing one up and one down at a different altitude of a few centimeters, 20, 30 centimeters, a few inches.
So put one on the table, one on the floor,
and you see the difference. There's more time on the table than on the floor. Or if you want, our head lives more than our feet.
Extraordinary thought, but it's not just that, is it? The relativity also challenged the very idea of what now might be.
Yes, and that's a second step, and it's a bit harder to digest, I think. So what is it? It's the fact that we have in our intuition a clear notion, which is the present, the now, okay? And this is completely obvious what we mean by now to us, and completely clear. And I think that after a century of discussion, the proper way of presenting the discovery is that this notion of now applies locally for things which are next to one another, but not globally. So let me explain. We're having a conversation. I look at you, you look at me, and we are in the same present. Right? I'm not having a conversation with you yesterday. A conversation with you now. And your now is my now. This is completely clear. So let's now open up a little bit more. I look at you, you look at me, means that light travels from my eyes to your eyes and back. How long does it take? Well, it takes a nanosecond or two. A nanosecond or two is nothing for us. So we forget about that. So in reality, I look at you not sort of now, but a little bit in the past, and you look at me and you're going to see me a little bit in the future. So between the you that I see and the you that is seeing me as I am now, there is a couple of nanoseconds.
A little gap.
A little gap, okay? But this gap is irrelevant in our conversation because we don't perceive nanoseconds. Nanoseconds are non-existing for us. Even if you were in Beijing and we were having a conversation on the phone, the gap would be milliseconds and would be totally negligible. So we can still have a common now. But if you were far away, imagine you were on Andromeda. Andromeda is a galaxy, right? In a clear night, you can see it. Probably not in London.
Not in this weather.
Not in this weather for sure. But of course, you see Andromeda and the light has taken millions of years to come to us. So the Andromeda we see and the Andromeda where some living beings in Andromeda, I don't know, green with antennas or whatever, is looking at us now, there is a distance between the two of many, many millions of years, okay? So between these millions of years, where is the now in Andromeda? Going into the math of special relativity, this question has no answer whatsoever. One can devise answers like Einstein's convention of simultaneity, but they don't define a common now which is objectively defined at all.
So, but it's not just relativity either. There's also an equally serious challenge from thermodynamics.
Yes, and this is, in a sense, deeply challenging to another of our obvious ideas about time, which is the past is different from the future. It is a long story, and it's a meandering story, which I think is not over yet. And it's a few steps. The first step was the surprise that the physicists encountered when they realized that the basic equations of mechanics, of electromagnetism, even of relativity, they don't distinguish the past from the future. So where is this distinction from past and future coming from? And the only equations of physics that distinguish the past from the future, and the only equation in my book, is the second law of thermodynamics, namely the law, the principle that says that entropy grows. So this was realized by the fathers of thermodynamics, and it seemed that it was a strange law. Entropy grows. It was not very clear because it was not clearly connected to the fundamental grammar of the world. But at least there was one clear point where the past is different from the future. Except that shortly after, Boltzmann realized entropy, this thing that grows, is just a macroscopic variable. The increase on entropy is a disordering of things. If you take a box with red balls on one side and green balls on the other side and you start shaking, they disorder themselves. Disorder grow, as everybody who has children knows, right? Disorder automatically grows by itself.
You don't have to untidy your room, you have to tidy it.
Right, you don't. Exactly. So does this explain everything? No, not at all. Because what does order mean? And even more importantly, why were things ordered in the past? For a child, it's easy because dad or mom ordered things, right? But in the universe, who ordered things in the past? And even what does it mean, things being ordered in the past?
Ordered by what metric?
Ordered by what metric, exactly. And the example of the red and the green balls is particularly interesting because if I'm colorblind, I don't see them. And vice versa, if somebody is sensible to another kind of frequency, another kind of color, maybe somebody is very good in distinguishing small balls from large balls, then order means small ball on one side and large ball on the other side, which can be something completely different from red and white. So order is in the eyes of the looker. It's really challenging. That's the meandering story is where things start to become very interesting. Because it seems that this growth of entropy, namely what distinguishes the past from the future, actually is tied to the way we simplify the world. I call the blurring, the blurred vision of the world in my book. And therefore, it's not just in the things, it's in the way we interact with the thing. Is it possible that I have as much knowledge of the past or ignorance of it as I do the future? Even allowing for the fact that our perceptions of the world are frequently wrong, can the world really be so profoundly different from our perception as this?
The challenge to our common sense notions of time from relativity and thermodynamics are serious enough. But when you add quantum mechanics to the mix, which tells us
that there is a minimum interval of time and that time is indeterminate outside of interactions, we've left the idea of time rolling on throughout the universe far behind. But if it's so problematic, how did Newton's picture of an absolute, true and mathematical time ever catch on?
Newton was badly wrong. Right? So why we honor him so much? Well, because he was also deadly right. Namely, his way of conceptualizing time works spectacularly well and truly well within the specific domain of small velocity, non-quantum situations, namely big actions, and not too strong gravity, and not very precise. So engineering, correctly so, use Newton equation when they build a house or bridge and they want to fly an airplane. And when they want to fly an airplane, they use the notion of time, which is Newtonian time, which is absolute, the same for everybody, and so on and so forth. Now, remarkably, this Newtonian time that we study at school, it is so ingrained in our way of thinking, it's not a natural, ancient way of looking of time for humanity. It's an idea by Newton. And I think this is something one should stop and think about, because often ideas that we consider natural, obvious, they're actually the result of great thinkers of the past that have convinced all of us that this is the case. They're inventions, right. They're good conceptual constructions that we employ. They're tools that we got from them and we made common to all of us. How were people thinking about time before Newton? Well, the common idea, both in the intellectual tradition, if you read the philosophers and the scientists before Newton, but also in everyday talking, is not that time is something that passes by itself. It's not that time is a huge clock outside the universe that ticks-tacks away the time of reality, but time is just a counting of things that change, right? What is time? It's day, night, day, night, day, night. So you count the days, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and that's the time. Or you count the hours, so you count the oscillation of a pendulum or something like that. That's the time. And it's a completely different idea than Newton. Because for Newton, time comes first and space comes first. So there's this huge space, empty, and time that passes. And then there's some matter moving around and doing stuff. But this is a Newton idea. Before Newton, that's for all the intermediate centuries of reflection about the world, there were things moving and clashing and doing stuff with one another, and time is just a counting of how this happened.
Part of the problem with studying time is that we just don't have the language, the grammar to describe it.
Yes. In fact, if we go back to the fact that there's no now in the universe as a whole, this is a fact. Now, if there's no now all over the universe, the philosopher has some work to do, right? And it's difficult also because we don't have the language, as you say. We talk in terms of things happening, having happened in the past, or something will happen in the future, and that's a grammar we use. And it's a wrong grammar. The grammar is not correct for the universe at large. It's very good for us, for our everyday life. We meet today, tomorrow we will meet, yesterday we met. And in the book, I mentioned some cute text from 2,000 years ago when people realized that the Earth is a sphere. And the text says something like, "For the people down, the things which are up are down, and which things which are down are up." Which makes no sense at all. It seems to be, you know, it's like that. It's just a nonsense. But it's not a nonsense. It's just these people struggling, talking about the fact that the other side of the Earth, Sydney, up means a different direction than up in London. So up is relative to where you are. And now we understand this perfectly, right? We have reconceptualized up and down in a manner which takes into account that the Earth is spherical, so it changes from place to place.
And that's the work we need to do for time.
And that's what we need to do for time. And we haven't done it yet, clearly.
When you write for a wider audience, is this partly why you try and use a lyrical, poetical style?
I think I use a poetical style because it's just me and I'm Italian. It comes.
But do you find it sometimes leads you astray, even?
I find that, look, science works. Its strength is in the fact that it can say things precisely, it can check facts and so on. But that's a tool. That's not the core of science, an instrument that science has. I can dream the crazy world I want, but I'm not a scientist until a mathematics that allows me to make a prediction I can test and the experimenter confirms it. Dreaming which sense? In the sense of having a vision of reality which is different from the previous one and imagining something completely new. So in that, it's very similar to poetry, because poetry is the same thing, right? It's creating combination of words that open up new meaning for us. Sometimes scientists are so attached to their rigor and precision, which they should, but they are so attached that they forbid themselves to say what they're really doing in their mind, which is dreams. Gone is the whiteness of snow. Green returns in the grass of the fields, in the canopies of the trees, and the airy grace of spring is with us again. Thus time revolves. The passing hours that steals the light brings a message.
You've been listening to Carlo Rovelli talking about the problems with our familiar picture of time and how poetry is one way to help us explore the mystery. After the break, we'll hear how a new vision of time needs to focus on events instead of things. More on that after we return.
Mark Edmondson, why read?
Why read? Well, the compressed answer is to change your life, to make it a little bit better than it is.
Hi, Daniel Glazer here. Our latest episode of A Neuroscientist Explains explores how the brain achieves the incredible feat of reading.
Words do have strong associations with sounds, and you can see that in the brain in most paradigms, but it depends what you're doing with the objects. As you learn to read and you become more familiar with it, you become more efficient at it, you become better at recognizing particular features, and so it becomes less work for your brain.
To have a listen, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search A Neuroscientist Explains on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back to this cross-section edition of the Science Weekly podcast. I'm your host, Richard Lee. Earlier in the show, we explored mysteries of time with the theoretical physicist, Carlo Rovelli. In this second half of the show, we'll be finding out how our experience of time is built on our particular place in the universe.
Who am I? I'm not my atoms, because my atoms have changed since childhood.
But first, Carlo explains why a new conception of time must be built out of happenings instead of stuff.
Somehow, the arc of the book is, first of all, time is not what you thought it is. Okay. So the first half of the book is meant to confuse the reader. So then what? Now, how do I think the world? And one is tempted to make a mistake. And I think physics made this mistake, and philosophy also made this mistake. But it's coming out from this mistake now. And now we're really in the core of the discussion. And what's the mistake? The mistake is, there's no time. So what I have to think about is a frozen world. Okay, imagine a block universe, nothing moves, everything is there, no change. Now, this is wrong, because if you look at yourself when you imagine that, what you're imagining is time. It's not moving in time. Time passes and nothing moves. So that's totally the wrong intuition, okay? The lack of time does not mean that nothing moves. It's the opposite. It means that we don't have to think at the world in terms of objects remaining in time. Right. A stone is a stone now, is the same stone tomorrow, is the same stone. So it's something which exists as time passes. For a relativist, it's a collection of stones. It's stone now, stone tomorrow, stone. So it's all these stones together. So is this one should let go and think at the stone moment by moment? Or think at the world in terms of entities which are limited in space but also in time. And these are events. Okay? So the world is like a sequence of snapping of fingers, many of them, but not an ordered sequence, an ensemble of events, a lot of things. So if you take all these happenings, which are not related to one another, but they don't form a long line in time, they just form this complicated, because of quantum mechanics, probabilistic connection. I think that's a good starting point for thinking of the world, which is compatible with modern physics.
But you're not saying that stones don't exist.
No, they do exist. And in fact, a stone exists. But what is a stone from the perspective of fundamental physics? Well, it's just a process. A stone is a lot of electrons going around the protons and interacting and vibrating. So it's a long vibration. So it's a sequence of processes, and we are processes, right? Who am I? I'm not my atoms, because my atoms have changed since childhood. I'm not my thoughts, because my thoughts have changed. So I'm a process. I'm the ensemble of all these things. And I span a little bit of time. And if I think of myself as a process instead of an entity, I think I understand myself better.
And we can describe those processes in various different ways at various different levels of precision.
Yes, we can describe these processes in different levels of precision. We can view a stone as just a piece of rock staying there, or we can view it as a set of atoms interacting, or we can view it like a person in geology looks at it, as a carrier of information about the story of our planet.
Or as a metaphor that Samuel Johnson can kick to refute Bishop Berkeley.
Absolutely. Or that little stone that my girlfriend gave me as a kid when I was a... and so on and so forth. And these are all right. This is all correct visions of the world. Each one gives us a different perspective, and they're all compatible, deeply compatible. That, I think, is an interesting point. In order to understand time, it is not enough to think of it from outside. It is necessary to understand that we, in every moment of our experience, are situated within time.
It is this ability to describe the world on different levels that allows us to begin recovering our notions of past and future. That mysterious low-entropy state at the Big Bang, which allows us to distinguish the arrow of time, turns out to depend on the particular way in which we choose to describe it.
Yes, this part of the book I describe the work that me and my colleagues in particular are doing, and this strange perspectival aspect of entropy. Entropy depends on the way we describe things. Not in the sense that it's arbitrary and subjective, because it's not that a cup of coffee a cup of tea cools down because we're English. It cools down because it cools down. But however, our description of it is crucial to be able to talk about this cooling down. And our description depends on the way we interact with it. We interact with a few variables, and it's a property of these few variables. So we should never forget that there is perspective, this relational core in the description of the world. And science has very often understood things in terms of our relation with things. One example of a light is the rotation of the star around us, right? The rotation of the sun, the moon. The sun goes up, goes down. The moon goes up and goes down. The stars goes up. Fantastic motion of the cosmos around us. And humanity has studied the cosmos for centuries before realizing that this great turning, in fact, is us spinning, okay? So it's not wrong, it's not illusory, it's not false, but it has to be understood not as a property of the stars, but as a property of the relation between us and the star. And that's good understanding. That's perfect understanding of a phenomenon. We have understood the rotation of the sky by looking at ourselves and other things, the colors. I mean, why there are three basic colors? Not because there is anything colored out there, but because we have three kinds of receptors in our eye. So we understand perfectly why there are three colors, but looking at our eyes, not looking outside. And I think something like that is going on with time. To understand the flow of time, the difference between the past and the future, we should not look at the universe at itself. We should look at a particular perspective that we as species of the universe, part of the universe, have in interacting with the rest of the universe.
So if the direction of flow from past to future is determined by, as you say, this relationship between us and the universe, by our description of the universe in some sense that we choose, then is it possible that there are other modes of existence, other ways of chopping the universe up into bits that could also give rise to beings and that we might be able to, in some sense, communicate with them?
Yeah, this is a bit science fiction and far away, but in principle, I think the answer is yes. I mean, in practice, I don't expect tomorrow getting a message from some living beings in a different temporality. It would certainly be hard to communicate with somebody who lives in a different... But in principle, yes. And in fact, let me say that we are here in a part of the discussion, which is really where the discussion is going on today in science, right? So is it possible actually to make this concrete and understand what, so to pinpoint exactly what is the specific or perspective of the world that allows the second principle of thermodynamics, allows the entropy to be low in the past. And we're working on that. But I think that there's progress going ahead. And this key intuition that there's something perspectival is it's a core idea that is taking ground.
So if you were attempting, if you were conceiving of the possibility of communicating with these other entities living in a different temporality, as you say, where would you go looking for messages or how would you leave one behind?
I don't know. There's a lot of part of this story which are not clear yet. Let me give you a small teeny example of one very concrete piece of science, which is very speculative. So let me be clear. I mean, we have been talking about well-established science.
Yeah, relativity is fine.
Right, very fine. Quantum mechanics, very fine, and so on. We have been talking about ideas which are not proven but largely believed by the scientists. Let me talk about something which is very tentative, very speculative. There is dark matter, which is something we don't know what it is. And one possibility, it is remnants of evaporated black holes. And it could be something which is called white holes, which is sort of a backward moving black holes, which one can think as a little teeny throat and a huge tail, a huge volume inside. So one calculation we've been doing recently is to take this hypothesis. I love this hypothesis. We don't know what's dark matter, so it could be that. And calculate if this is so, and if this white hole existed already at the moment of the Big Bang, and if the Big Bang was, another hypothesis, a bounce from a previous universe, at the moment of the bounce, so the universe compressed, get the minimum size, and then bounce, what was the geometry there? And the geometry there is that there are all these bugs, these little holes with these long tails. The majority of the volume of the universe is inside there, not outside. So we are outside, descendants of whatever was outside. So we are in a very special position because we're outside. So we don't have a common perspective of the universe. We have a very particular perspective of the universe. We're sitting on top of a mountain. And because of that, we see a special past because we are in a special position. So we're in a special position, and this special aspect of our position determine a very particular kind of order in which we see the world, which is the initial low entropy of the universe.
Which is why there's all this dark matter about the place as well.
Yes. And am I sure of that? No. I mean, sure, no.
But a marvelous story.
Could it be? Perhaps. Or maybe it's another story of that kind that somebody else smarter could come out with.
The picture of time as being constructed from this way in which we describe the world puts human beings right back at the centre of the universe in some sense, even though you've just said we may or may not be in a different space to most of it. Does it change the way that we should live our lives?
Well, look, there is one more chapter of the story, I would say, which is the following. This story still has a lot missing, and what is missing is the full reconstruction of our sense of passing time. Why do we see this passing? What are exactly we perceiving it? Why do we have this sense of an open window of a little bit of the past and even smaller bit of the future? I think that this has to be answered by the people who study the brain and not by the physicists. And this is important because both in philosophy, but also in physics and in contemporary discussion about all that, sort of blame fundamental physics that something was missing there. But I think it's not missing because there's something else outside physics. It's missing because we're complicated things and there are aspects of the world that depend on us being complicated thing. We shouldn't be searched into the fundamental physics. We shouldn't be searched there because they depend on our brain. And the idea that the way we perceive time depends on the specific of our brain is an idea that several philosophers have contemplated in the past, and I think is a dead right idea. It goes back to Augustine, Saint Augustine, when he noticed that we think about time, and he was thinking about music, we talk about music. He was saying, we hear a musical phrase, okay, we appreciate this meaning in a musical phrase, but wait a moment, we hear only one note at a time. So right now, I'm hearing music. There's just one sound. How the hell do I get the full phrase? Okay. And the answer is that I have memory of the past and my brain anticipates the future. But this means that when we think about time, we're actually referring to our memories and anticipation. And Husserl insists on that. The time of our mind or our thinking about temporality is not the time of physics. It's the time of our memory and anticipation. And we should not confuse the two. They're two different things. So our brain is a physical thing which exploits the second law of thermodynamic that allows traces to exist to have today some connection to the past, which we call memory. And it's a machine. Dean Bonomano is a neuroscientist in America today. He wrote a book, Your Brain is a Time Machine. Because your brain is something that uses memories to anticipate the future and makes all this working, complicated, complex working, all these billions of neurons that are in our mind. And an ensemble of events now, in the local now, connected to some events in the close past, which try to anticipate event in the future. And this working is what we call time, which is loosely connected to the time of physics, but it's not the same thing. So I think that one has to look at neuroscience to understand the sense of flow, the sense of opening, and Heidegger would say this clearing around us, which is the time of our experience. The time of our experience is loosely connected to the time of physics, but is actually built up from our brain as a machine. And that's why, now coming to your question, that's why this is relevant for us. Because studying time, we're studying what we are. We are this machine, which is our brain, opening us this clearing. We are time. We are this history that we tell us to ourselves about ourselves. We are this narration about ourselves. We are made by memory. I believe we're a piece of nature, a piece of matter and energy and everything which the rest of the world is made of. But the particular way we are made, exploiting the fact that locally around us, the way we relate to the rest, allows us to construct this memory anticipation, this machine that was built by evolution, and give us the sense of a flowing time and a past, a future, an opening. It's a core of ourselves, it's a core of our consciousness, and that's the core of time as we perceive it.
Special thanks this week to Carla Rovelli. If you want to find out more, we'll include a link to The Order of Time in the episode's description on the Guardian website. If you've got any questions, queries, or feedback, please get in touch via our email address, scienceweekly@theguardian.com. I'm Richard Lee. This is Science Weekly.
From The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.